Hello and welcome to the Hippocampus podcast, a place where we discuss the strategies that help optimise learning. So join us for some grassroots conversations where we share some practical tips and insights that might just make your learning journey a little easier.
In this episode, we're joined by Dr. Paul Penn, a senior lecturer in psychology at the University of East London, who has a vast experience in the psychology of learning and its application. With Dr. Penn, we explore what cognitive science research says about effective studying and why that can differ quite considerably from how we think we should study. We also discuss the concept of metacognition and desirable difficulties, what these actually are and why they're so important for us as learners. So let's join the hosts, me, Sophie, I'm a medical student, and Lisa, who is a lecturer in medical education. Welcome back and hello. How are we, Lisa?
I am not so bad, Sophie, on this lovely Friday afternoon.
We're leading into the bank holiday, living the dream.
Living the dream.
So, exciting episode today. We're having a special guest on with us. Dr. Paul Penn. Dr. Penn is a senior lecturer in psychology at the University of East London and has extensive expertise in the psychology of learning and its application to studying and learning. Dr. Penn teaches a variety of undergraduate and postgraduate topics at the university and also leads workshops that facilitate the acquisition and development of key skills. He's even written a book on the topic, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on in the episode. So hi, Paul, how are you doing?
Hi there. I'm very happy to be here. I'm doing very well, thanks. I'm looking forward to sort of getting out of the lockdown conditions, you know, come whenever it is now. Is it May 17th or something like that, isn't it, when we're allowed to meet in person again?
Exciting.
Yeah. Looking forward to that. Tired of being a hermit.
Tell me about it. It's time, isn't it now? It's time.
Yeah, it's definitely time. Subject to the conditions being right. Obviously, we don't want to go back into another lockdown because of impatience. But yeah, we're all chomping at the bit, I think, to get outside and meet people and all that kind of good stuff again.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to join us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Brilliant. So let's start things off then with thinking about the opening chapter in your book, The Psychology of Effective Studying. You mentioned this term metacognition, and it's a term that I'm becoming increasingly familiar with as a lecturer, and the more I kind of read around, you know, the science of learning. And it's something that, you know, we're really keen to support our students in terms of starting to get meta or metacognitive, because as you describe in your book, it's the foundation to successful studying. Could you perhaps just explain actually what we mean when we talk about metacognition and why it is so important?
Yeah, sure. Well, basically, when we talk about metacognition, we tend to think about the sort of working definition as thinking about thinking. But I've always been a bit sort of, I don't know, sketchy with that, because it makes it sound like a bit of a, I don't know, esoteric thing to do. Like it might be interesting to academics and really not much application to students who are trying to figure out how to study more effectively. But when you look at it in terms of, okay, well, let's consider what metacognitive ability is, which you can, you know, broadly define as our ability to, if you like, accurately perceive our level of knowledge or competence and reflect on the success or otherwise of the approaches we're using to learning. Suddenly its significance becomes very clear, because really, I mean, at a fundamental level, your learning is inextricably tied to what you think you already know. You know, if you already think you have expert level of knowledge of something, you're probably not going to invest much time and effort into studying it. Equally, if you're fairly convinced you already know how to study, you're probably not going to engage with any help, you know, that's offered to you in terms of, well, let's try and address the way you study and see if we can improve it. So that's really why it's the first chapter of my book, because it's that do not pass go, do not collect $200 moment, really. Because if you're not receptive to the idea, because you think already, you know, I'm fine with my studying, then, you know, you continue on in ignorance and you may be undermining your learning perpetually throughout your entire degree. So really the first chapter of the book was just to try and explain and, if you like, explode some of the myths that we have about learning and what works and what doesn't, and the way that certain aspects of our metacognitive ability, if you like, is pretty flawed. you know, there are a number of quirks, and most of us will have heard, for example, of the Dunning-Kruger effect. You know, I don't know if you've had a podcast about that or anyone talk about that before. But I mean, in a sentence, really, it means that we are the most vulnerable to having an inflated perception of our knowledge and our competence when we are the least knowledgeable or the least competent. You know, so that's not good, particularly if it comes to something really big like, you know, how to study.
Yeah.
Because that's going to handicap your studying right from the outset. There's things like, you know, we tend to make illusory judgments of learning. So, you know, we'll be happily reading our textbooks and we'll read the same thing over and over again. And the subjective impression we get is that we'll be able to recall this stuff. But of course, we haven't considered the fact that when we're tested on this material, we're not going to have that source available. And as daft as that sounds, that's a very common kind of issue with studying, in that people don't correctly anticipate the conditions of recall and don't sort of incorporate that into their studying. You know, we tend to conflate factual recall with understanding, for example. You know, we think if we can recall something, then we understand it. And that's really not the case at all. We tend to look back on knowledge that we've got, you know, previously as being obvious or self-evident or easily obtained, you know, which tends to kind of mean that we don't perhaps engage with subsequent stuff as in an effortful manner as we should, because, you know, we think, oh, that was easy in the past, so why bother? So there's all of those things really which do serve as kind of impediments to, I think, sometimes people looking at the way they study and looking at their metacognition. And combined with the very practical thing, obviously, that when you're talking to university students and you're trying to convince them perhaps that they could go about studying more effectively, it's understandable they might be a bit reticent, because their argument will be, well, I've got where I've got thus far doing what I've done. So, you know, why change? So it really is an uphill battle in some way to try and convince people that they actually, you know, could use a bit of a tune up when it comes to studying, and to really investigate what psychology and the various learning sciences have to say about how we can learn more effectively.
Definitely. What do you think drives that kind of misperception of those judgments of your own abilities? Like, why are we so poor? You know, not just, you know, we're all bad at it, aren't we?
Yeah, it's fair. I mean, these kind of things like, you know, erroneous judgments of learning, you know, let's say, you know, the people that don't, for example, or jump to conclusions about their understanding of the topic based on their factual recall. These are definitely quirks that kind of we all share, fairly well established in, you know, psychology. And when you look at the way that students actually study, the kind of depressing thing is that if you have like a table and it shows, you know, what proportion of students use a particular strategy, the ones that are at the top in terms of frequency of use are the ones that are at the bottom in terms of their efficacy. So, you know, you'll get the perennial favourites like, you know, rereading, highlighting, all of that kind of stuff at the top. And yet what we know from psychology suggests that actually these don't work anywhere near as well as we think they do, or people are inclined to think they do. But I think part of it's because there's a lack of understanding. And, you know, I think that there's been a good number of researchers about this really, where they've looked into why students use ineffective study strategies. And sometimes it's just a case of not realizing that they don't work as well as you think they do. So, you know, things like retrieval practice, if you give students, you know, let's say an article to learn, and you just read the article a few times, and the other ones, you know, you say, okay, well, we're going to give you a series of questions, and you just, you know, rehearse the questions, as it were, and try and improve every time, the students will anticipate they'll do equally well, irrespective of what method they use. But actually, it's the students that actually try and retrieve the material and practice the process of retrieval that will do a lot better. So a part of it, I think, is a bit of education, in that, you know, I don't know about you, but I was never taught this at school. You know, we were never taught how to study, you know, and a lot of the stuff that you do remember from school is things like, you know, remember your times table, you did that by rote rehearsal, you know, once two is two, all that kind of stuff. And you just think afterwards that people are trying to apply that kind of mental muscle approach, where you just repeat things over and over again, to material where it's really not suited to, where, you know, that approach just won't work. It certainly won't work very well anyway, and it will take an awful lot of effort and an awful lot of, you know, pulling your hair out. So I think that's part of it. And I think perhaps later on, when we get talking about desirable difficulties and things like that, we can get onto this misconception that learning should be simple and learning should be error-free. And that if you're making mistakes, then that's a bad indictment of the method you're using to learn. When in point of fact, it's the opposite, and mistakes are an integral part of learning. you know, they're not really optional. Doing things suboptimally and then, you know, looking at the feedback and improving is the essence of learning, really. And I think some people assume that if the method they're using involves mistakes, it means it's an indictment on the method and it means the method isn't working. So I think those kind of two big reasons why people tend to make these kind of errors.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, do you think it's a bit uncomfortable to do things like active recall and testing yourself because you don't feel like you're getting things right and you're progressing until a bit further down the line when you start to realize that those facts become embedded, whereas things like reading and highlighting are really easy and passive and you feel like you're doing something even when that's perhaps not the most effective thing?
Yeah, there's an old saying, isn't there? It's don't mistake activity for achievement. And the thing about you know, highlighting and rereading and things like that is, and another one which people tend to do which doesn't work is verbatim note taking, you know, where they'll just copy words out verbatim. You know, you'll end up with a lot of pages of, you know, notes and things like that and a lot of highlighted material, and superficially it looks like you've made progress, but actually in the case of a highlighting, all you've been doing is coloring things in, you know, that's not really particularly helpful to you. And yeah, you're right. I mean, a lot of the reason that I think some of the less effective modes of study and the most popular is they don't challenge you. They don't have any metacognitive correction built into them. So if you're rereading something, the subjective impression you get is this is feeling more familiar, ergo I must be learning. But that feeling of familiarity is actually illusory. Whereas if you're doing retrieval practice, what's going to happen, particularly at first, is you're probably not going to remember much at all. And you'll probably make quite a few errors. So the subjective impression is, oh my God, I'm rubbish. You know, people don't necessarily want to be confronted with that at the initial stages of learning because they think it'll be demoralizing. But again, it's about dissociating short-term performance from long-term learning. Because, you know, the research tends to indicate that short-term indicators of learning, particularly if they're done under invalid testing conditions, don't translate to longer-term learning. So it's that giving yourself permission to make mistakes, to, you know, fail to recall something, and to understand that those mistakes are actually helpful to your learning, and they reflect positively on the method you're using rather than, you know, negatively.
Mm-hmm. This is always the things in life, isn't it, that you get wrong that you learn the most from. And I think I've had this recently where I've kind of been doing like question banks in preparation for exams and things, and you think, oh my God, I'm getting like 30%, I'm not going to pass an exam with that. But then the next time a question comes up on that topic and you got it wrong, you're not going to make the same mistake again. But yeah, it's definitely that horrible feeling I think people try and avoid, and it's just like nice to make some pretty notes and feel like you've done something.
You can't avoid, you know, I always say to students this when they get despondent about, you know, perhaps they got a poor grade on an essay or they've, you know, not done so well in MCQ. And I say, look, if you knew everything already, the process of getting a degree would be you turn up on the first day, hand over £28,000, and we give you a degree and say congratulations. It doesn't work like that for a reason. You know, you've got to sweat a bit. You've got to, you know, you've got to challenge yourself. You have to be confronted in areas where you're, you know, you're not perhaps as good as you think you are, or perhaps, you know, you're falling short of the mark at that particular point in time. But, you know, the thing is not to obsess about grades. Look at trajectory. So, you know, you might start off by failing, but the next time, you know, you might get a bit of a better mark. And then the time after that, you get a better mark. And eventually you're up in the higher mark range. And just because that doesn't happen overnight or because it doesn't happen from the outset, you know, that's nothing to be ashamed of or to be surprised by, because that's the case for the most people. So learning is about trajectory. It's not about, you know, one-time marks, really. And I think that's something which is perhaps lost on some students. The first time they get a bad mark, you know, the head goes into the sand. And they're like, oh, no, it didn't happen. You know, and it did. Now your job is to find out why. And that's learning in a nutshell. You know, you do something optimally, you get feedback, you implement the feedback, and then you do better next time. So, yeah, I think that's the kind of key to it, really. Mm-hmm. But it's not pleasant, as you say. No. You know, it's not something which is, you know, none of us, I think, like to be criticised as we see it. None of us like to get a bad mark because, you know, at least to varying extents, we're all a little bit, you know, extrinsically motivated like that. We want, you know, we want recognition, we want good marks. But the pursuit of marks is really to lose the lesson. You know, there's so much more to your learning than just the final grade. Yeah. And there's so much more to testing as well than something that's done to you at the end of a course. It should be something which you do informally to yourself as an integral part of learning. You know, so that fear of testing and that stigma around testing, I think, is a really harmful thing too, because there are different types of tests. And, you know, some of them are really, really, really helpful to learning as well. So, you know, you've got to embrace that rather than look at testing as a dirty word almost.
Yeah. And I think this probably will lead nicely into this idea, this term of desirable difficulties, and that a lot of what are the more effective learning strategies for durable learning are things that encourage those desirable difficulties. So what's this distinction between the difficulty and that difficulty being desirable, and therefore an effective sort of approach to studying?
Yeah, it's a good point, because having something which is difficult to implement doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be an effective strategy. But having something that is difficult in that it will identify errors in what you're doing efficiently, and it will require you to engage with it and then respond to those errors constructively. It will confront you with you know, parts of your knowledge that are perhaps lacking. That's what distinguishes, I think, constructive difficulty from just something which is awkward or ungainly sort of to implement, basically. And that's what it's about. I think a good analogy is learning is a bit like going to the gym. You know, if you go to the gym and you stand around and you listen to your iPod, and you don't really, you know, get involved in the weights or whatever you're doing, you know, you're not going to benefit from it. If you go to the gym and you know, you get down to it what you're doing actually makes you sweat and it's hard work, that's where you benefit. And it's the same with learning, really. If you're trying to learn something, and a good example is when people reread something, they might think, oh, yeah, I've got to test myself. So what they'll do is that they'll put their book down, and literally 10 seconds after they've read it, they'll just try and remember one isolate. And you're thinking, hang on, that's not anywhere near challenging enough. That's like if you're Arnold Schwarzenegger and going to the gym, you know, getting on the bench press and not putting any weight on the bar. You know, you're not challenging yourself. You're not making the exercise difficult. Therefore, you're not going to benefit. So in some ways, I think you have to look to the extent to which you're being challenged and you're imposing those kind of challenges on yourself. But that doesn't mean to say you have to, you know, resort to really difficult to implement, you know, strategies for learning. It could be just something as simple as, you know, breaking your source down into smaller chunks, testing yourself on those chunks. So actually just putting your books to one side, recalling it after about 10 minutes at first, and then gradually leaving an incremental amount of time between each time you try and test yourself. So it gets progressively more difficult. So, you know, you start off thinking in minutes, then you maybe think of a couple of hours, then you maybe think of, you know, half a day, then you try and remember it 2 days down the line, you know, and that kind of thing will really help you. That's sort of the distributed practice model of learning, which you've no doubt heard of before. And it's the thing that we always bang on about this time of year when exams are coming up. We say, you know, don't cram, try and distribute your time into much shorter sessions that are, you know, more numerous, but are divided by intervals of time. And if you're studying material that can be easily confused, consider making those intervals of time increase, you know, every time you actually go back to a study session. So it's really just, I think, exposing yourself to challenge. If you're freewheeling along and nothing is challenging you, then probably something is wrong. There's the old expression, isn't there, that, you know, your mum would have told you, which is something like, if you go looking for trouble, you find it. With learning, it's a bit different. If you don't go looking for trouble, it will find you. So, you know, you've almost got to try and continually have that mindset of, okay, let's test this. You know, it's not what I think I know that counts. It's what I can prove that I know that really matters.
I think that's an important point as well about the use of kind of retrieval activities and retrieval practice, which, you know, in some regards has become popularized through the use of flashcards, like Anki and so on. But even then, there's nuances, isn't there, where sometimes it's the analogy like you described with the weights. It's that you're lifting the bars up, but there's no weights on the bars, in that you're engaging in an activity that you think is an effective use of retrieval and recall, but actually, is it really? And, you know, we see students sometimes who are using flashcards almost like another version of notes, is that they'll read the question on the front, turn it over and read the answer. And there isn't that real effort, that difficulty that really they're missing a trick with, given, you know, they're kind of trying to engage in that process.
Yeah, I mean, this is the danger sometimes, isn't it? You'll get these kind of, almost like fads turn around. People will say flashcards, brilliant, but it's how you use them that's the important thing there. And I'm sure we've all seen it, students outside of exams all have flashcards, and they are effectively, they're very, very brief summaries, but they're not actually challenging the student to recall the information. The students just read them. And even if they do sometimes try and recall the information, what they'll do is if they encounter a flashcard that they struggle with, they'll just throw it out the pack or put it at the back of the pack. And you're like, no, that's the last thing you should be doing. That's your metacognitive correction right there. It's saying you don't know this. You need to invest a bit more effort and, you know, into retrieving this information. And the thing about summarization as well is we you know, intuitively, it seems like a very good thing to do. And it can be if you're quite practiced and you know, you know what the danger or the red flags are, as it were. But what tends to happen is the research on summarization suggests it's only as good as the quality of the summarization itself. And that what tends to happen is that people initially, untrained, aren't especially good at summarizing things. They miss out the key points. They include irrelevant detail. Perhaps their summaries are too short, aren't going to be helpful for them. So, you know, in some ways, I think the idea of you always have to try and reduce things, which I think is implicit in summarization. You know, you have to try and reduce the volume of words or reduce the number of points. What the research tends to tell us is actually it's usually the other way around. And if you elaborate on things, and if you work on trying to explain them, and you work on questioning them and trying to identify, you know, how they relate to other material, that works much better. So flashcards are good if you use them properly as a retrieval aid tool and you don't cheat, you know, and you shuffle them up and you make it difficult for yourself and things like that. But otherwise, it's just tokenism. You know, if you just have all these flashcards and you're just reading them to yourself and then immediately looking at the answer and saying, yeah, I know that now, that's not really doing you any good whatsoever, really.
I think the danger with flashcards as well is sometimes because you've written them, you know what you're looking for, whereas exam questions are written by someone else, and half the battle is like working out what they want from you and are you answering the question correctly and things like that. And you're looking for your flashcards and you think, oh yeah, I know the answer to that because you've memorized the answer like word for word a million times, but you've not actually understood the concept behind it.
Yeah, that's kind of the illusion of understanding we were referring to earlier here. And it's you know, the studies of that are actually really interesting, and particularly for psychology students, when you say to them something like, how would you design an experiment that distinguished between whether someone can just recall something or whether someone actually understands that information? And one of the ways it's done is you include contradictory information in a passage of text, and ostensibly the person is just asked to recall, you know, the crux of the text or the key points. But then you also say to them, did you see anything unusual or did you spot a contradiction? And you look to see if their perception of their understanding matches with their ability to spot those contradictions. So if someone says, yes, I did understand this, but also says, and by the way, there's a contradiction in line 2 and line 3 here, then their perception is critical. They have understood something. Mm-hmm. But if they say, yeah, I understood it perfectly and completely missed the contradictions, no, what they've actually done then is recalled some of the crux of the information, but they've only engaged it at a very superficial level. They haven't really understood what it means. And as you say, that's kind of key, particularly when you don't know the question that's going to be asked in the exam, because it's that understanding that will then generate that kind of cognitive flexibility for you to interrogate what you know and formulate that into an argument or an answer. Whereas if you rigidly stuck to just, you know, answering a particular question or phrasing something in a particular way, if the question is a bit different, it's going to throw you off, as it were. And this is something that's really important, particularly for memory, is to try and recreate the conditions of the exam when you're studying, so that the information you get about your capacity to deal with that material is valid. Because otherwise, as you say, if you're making things really easy for yourself and you've always got your books to hand and you're not imposing a time limit on yourself, things like that, you know, you're going to get an erroneous idea about how well you'll perform on the day.
Mm-hmm. Bringing the conversation then over to memory, you know, obviously memory is a foundation to learning. Could you perhaps just expand a little bit on, you know, what are the mechanisms of memory and actually how can we exploit them, I suppose, in terms of how are they being exploited through techniques such as retrieval practice or spacing?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think there's a misconception, and this is particularly important for students that aren't studying psychology, you know, because I'm acutely aware that, you know, if you're doing organic chemistry or, you know, you're studying medicine and things like that, the last thing you want to be told, in addition to all this subject knowledge, you've got to be an expert on memory and things like that as well. You can understand people, like, I've got enough to do, please, no. But you really, there's just a couple of key principles of the way that memory works that I think it pays to be acquainted with. And just knowing that those two things can really transform the way you study. And the first really is just to understand that memory isn't a process of reproduction. You know, I say it in the book, your memory doesn't work like a camera. So there's no point in studying as if it did. You know, you can passively look at text all you want, but, you know, it's going to be a monumental effort to try and recall any of it then, because your memory doesn't really want to reproduce someone else's understanding. Particularly if you haven't engaged it particularly extensively. What it wants you to do is to reconstruct that knowledge for yourself. It wants you to interrogate that knowledge. It wants you to explain it in your own words. It wants you to consider the relationship between this new incoming knowledge and your existing knowledge. You know, so just getting that idea that don't study as if your memory functioned like a camera. You know, you've got to study and understand that what your memory does is it reconstructs things in a way that reflects or is consistent in some way what you already know, what you expect to happen, maybe some, you know, cultural factors in there as well. You've got this huge sort of bank of knowledge already. And what we're really looking for is to see how well you can integrate new income information with that kind of knowledge. So that's the first thing, I think, that kind of that reconstructive nature of memory. And that's nothing new. So we've known this for a long time. And yet, when you look at the way that students study, often they do study as if they were just trying to, you know, almost like take a picture of the text with their eyes, you know, and just reread it and try and force it in that way through osmosis or something. So that's the first principle. The second thing is really your memory thrives on retrieval. You know, it wants to practice retrieving information. And as we said before, you've got to get away from the view that failing to retrieve something is a bad thing, because retrieval failure actually helps. It helps your memory, because what it's doing is it's serving that metacognitive correction capacity that we referred to earlier. It's telling you, you don't know this yet. You might have thought you did, but you don't, because under testing conditions, you can't remember it. So, you know, maybe go back and hit the books, or, you know, and then test yourself again, and maybe you'll remember a bit more next time. So it's kind of an iterative process, basically, and you can't expect to do something the first time round and you know, commit it all to memory. So you've got to start thinking really as the process for remembering something or testing yourself as integral to improving your memory and actually being able to recall things more readily and more accurately. So yeah, I think those are the two kind of key things. Another thing that sometimes gets mentioned, other times perhaps not as much as it should, is things like organization. So, you know, make sure that you are, you know, organizing your recall appropriately, putting things into the right category, because that will help your memory. Your memory doesn't really like disorder and chaos. It really wants you to think in terms of categorical hierarchies. How do things relate to previous things? And the reason for that is that when you think about it, what is the prerequisite for being able to categorize things? Well, you need to know about something about them. You need to understand them at some level, don't you, to see what they've got in common or how they differ. So that's one of the benefits, really, of thinking about categorizing knowledge. And I think sometimes that's why people use mind maps and things like that. It's just to try and sketch out the relationship between things.
That's really helpful. I think it's good to have a few things to focus on when you're not so familiar with the psychology and the underlying science of learning, to be able to implement and help your learning and revision. So obviously we've spoken a bit about how just reading things passively doesn't help it go in. As medical students, we have a lot of pre-reading and extra reading that we get told to go away and do as part of our studies. How can students engage with their reading best to optimize their learning, contrasting with the issue of just rereading things?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to say here is that and anyone that sort of teaches and probably students will recognize this as well. Sometimes the process of doing a degree can almost seem like a reading contest, you know, because you have these big long reading lists and you think, how am I supposed to get through all this stuff? You know, and what I often do to students, and Stephen Chu, who's over in Stanford, did a really nice video about this once. And it was just beliefs that make, you know, make your studying suffer, or beliefs that make you, you know, less successful than you could be. He modeled this one scenario where a student said, hey, you know, Professor Chu, I've done all this reading. And he's got this speech bubble next to his head. He said, no, actually, what you've just done is you've read something because I told you to, and you haven't really taken it in. You've just taken a quantity over quality approach, as it were. And that's it. And if you ask sometimes students why they're reading a particular source, they'll say, well, my tutor said it would be useful. And you're like, no, you're just reading aimlessly in that case. You know, if you think about it, if you don't have any questions or specific aims when you're reading something, the text can't give you any answers. You're just skimming over it, hoping that something will pop out at you. And the chances are it won't, because, you know, the information is equally salient because you haven't given yourself priorities of what to look for. You haven't posed questions about, you know, the kind of material that will give you the answers to the questions that you have. So you've really got to think about avoiding reading aimlessly. Don't say, well, I've got two chapters to read here. I've got to read them both from cover to cover. Say, well, actually, the purpose here is to perhaps learn about, that if you're a medic, perhaps the bones in the hand or something, or in a particular finger. So let's just try and focus in on that particular topic. But I'm also going to ask myself some questions that I want that text to answer in advance, you know, and then you're looking out for that information. It's becoming salient there, you know, and I sort of make the joke in the book that it's almost like an academic version of the 50 Shades of Grey book. You know, when you ask me about 50 Shades of Grey and how they read it, they said, I'll skip to the good bits. You know, no one reads the rest of it. Well, maybe it's just me. I don't know. But you know, same with when you're reading academically, though. What are the good bits? Which are the bits that are priorities for you at this point in time? Which are the bits that are going to answer the questions you've set yourself? And that's kind of what you need to bear in mind, basically, that, you know, the information isn't of equal salience. It depends on what you're trying to learn at that particular time. And you have to be very selective about what you zero in on. The other good thing as well, particularly I think perhaps for medical students as well, where there's a lot of factual information, is to immediately challenge it and ask why it's the case. So, you know, we call this elaborative interrogation, and you might have come across this before, but it's this idea that as you're reading, you're actively engaging with the reading by, if you see an assertion being made, your immediate task is to stop and try and explain that assertion or the evidence for it or how it works in your own words. And that sort of, and the more detail you can give on the explanation, like a causal reason for two things being related, the better. It seems like the more elaboration you've got in terms of the reason that two things are related or one thing causes another thing, the better it is in terms of the likelihood you'll remember it, basically. So that's another good strategy as well. So, you know, in summary, really, it's being sure and focusing on what you need to read, rather than just trying to impress people by the volume of reading you've done, having questions that the text can then answer or help you answer. And also anything you encounter, which is an assertion or a fact, immediately ask yourself, okay, I have to explain this now. And I have to explain it to someone who's yet to do the reading that I've done. Because, you know, one of the quirks we have, again, metacognitively, is once we understand something or have some understanding of it, we tend to assume other people have a similar level of understanding. So if we explain it, we start omitting all the good stuff, thinking they already know it, when in point of fact, they're scratching their head thinking, yeah, I don't know any of this stuff yet. Can you go back and cover that, please? So a good way of getting around that is to think, I've got to explain this to my mum or my dad or my significant other that, you know, hasn't done 2 years of a medical degree or 2 years of a degree in organic chemistry, and see if you can do that. And if you can, brilliant. That probably means you're not going to forget about that in a hurry then. It's why they always say that teaching is a good way of, you know, ensuring you remember something, because then you have to think about explaining things. You can't just stand up. Well, you can't, if you want to be popular, you can't stand up the front and just regurgitate facts. It's all about creating a narrative and trying to generate understanding and stimulate interest. And that's the good stuff in terms of, you know, actively engaging with material.
Do you know what, as well, that's really relevant to us as well, in the sense of, as medics, we're going to have to go and explain things to patients on a daily basis in layman's terms. And I don't think you realise how difficult it is until you try and do it. And that is, I think, because we don't practice it enough while we're absolutely training. And if we did it more, perhaps it would benefit us and not just the patients as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those things, it's a shame that there's just a little bit missing in the public consciousness here, because most people have heard of things like the curse of knowledge. If you said to people the curse, they'd have some idea of what you meant by it, but probably not completely understand it. And if you just say, well, actually, that's just because you're anchored in your own perspective. You know, once you know something, it's obvious to you, it's done. But you can't go back to that time before you knew that knowledge. Once you know something, it's very difficult to unknow it. or to decenter from that perspective of someone who does know it. And it tends to be only when you think about, okay, I've got to imagine an audience in front of me, and I've got to start now saying, what level of expertise does that audience have, and how does that then affect the exposition that I give them? And I think your example is a great one, because you have to take very complex phenomena and describe it in a way which is still respectful, not patronizing, but reflects the fact that person hasn't done a medical degree, you know, and is probably upset at the time as well, because either they're ill or a friend or loved one is ill. So yeah, it's a really good example, I think.
Yeah, definitely. We've sort of heard people describe it as the Feynman technique, that kind of take something and strip it back and explain it in its simplest terms. And I think that the nice thing about that technique as well is that you could still kind of practice that even if you haven't actually got someone in front of you. Mm-hmm. You can just sort of sit in your room and just imagine that you're spending 5 minutes teaching, like you say, someone who, you know, isn't as familiar with the topic, you know. But I think it's a really helpful exercise, isn't it? In one, it's engaging that process of recall and retrieval, and that reconstruction of ensuring that, you know, you understand it well enough to put it into your own words. Mm. And I think the other issue sometimes is, particularly with subjects where there is a lot of jargon and specialist languages, it's very easy to hide behind those words and use them and not really know what they mean. But yeah, again, if you're using these words and you think, well, actually, if I have to explain exactly what I mean by this term, I have to understand exactly what this term is. And I think it's a really useful exercise for being metacognitive, again, finding those errors in your thinking and realizing, well, I'm using these words, but I've no idea what they mean.
Absolutely. And the great thing about things like, you know, elaborative interrogation and things like that is that people tend to assume they only work if you already know quite a bit about the subject or you're really interested in it. But actually, it's not the case at all. And they can have even more utility for people that don't know much about the subject, and that perhaps it's not really their first choice of what they'd like to study, which, you know, is going to happen to all of us. No matter how enthusiastic you are about, you know, your degree generally, there will be topics that you prefer to other topics, and some topics that are a bit of a chore. And of course, they'll be the topics you tend to procrastinate on, you know. But yeah, things like elaborative interrogation, that process of explaining things, tends to work, you know, in even more pronounced fashion when you're perhaps not an expert on something, or you're not especially enthusiastic about it. So yeah, that it's definitely worth a technique that's very powerful, regardless of your level of expertise or your interest in a topic.
Brilliant. So we've kind of highlighted the types of techniques and thinking about learning that are pretty well supported in terms of evidence for being effective, which kind of brings on to some of the sort of popular myths that circulate around not just students, but also educators, you know, the wider sort of teaching profession still, on thoughts about how people learn that are actually quite, as we now know, misinformed and not based on any particular sort of evidence that's supporting them. And the thing that immediately comes to mind is this idea of learning styles. And it's still something that is so pervasive that, you know, it's become a bit of a trigger word for me. I know that Sophie and the other podcast hosts will be sick of my irritation around this. But just, I think perhaps, I suppose with learning styles, it's first sort of all defining what actually we mean by the learning styles and why are they so popular, and actually, you know, what does the research say?
Yeah, learning styles has become something I think of almost like a triggering term for anyone that's kind of dealing with sort of psychology and learning sciences and things like that at the moment. I think. So the way I usually use the whole VARK or VAK learning styles, which is this idea that people have preferences about the way they learn. Some people prefer to just, you know, look at material visually, you know, try and process the material visually. Other people tend to prefer, you know, auditory processing, listening to things. Other people might prefer, you know, to actually physically manipulate information somehow, you know, the kinesthetic style of learning. And the idea is that people learn more effectively when they're using their preferred learning style. And of course, what we know from the research is that's really not the case at all. And really, learning styles are pretty much a waste of time in terms of if you want to learn more effectively. I always joke, you're as well off knowing someone's star sign as you are their learning style if you want to try and help them learn, really. They both are probably equal utility in that respect. But I think the reason they remain so popular and that it's become such a stubborn myth to try and dispel, well, there's a number of reasons. I think the first thing is it probably comes from a good place, like all education, really, in that particularly in individualistic societies where, you know, the individual is considered very important, there is a concern about people being left behind, us, you know, trying to take a one-size-fits-all approach and certain groups becoming marginalised or left behind. But and that's a perfectly noble concern, but you've got to then look, okay, well, if that is the risk, how do we effectively deal with that? Let's not get tokenistic about this and just throw things at them we know don't work. Let's try and actually interrogate what we can do. But there's other things as well. In that, I think there's intuitive appeal to it, this idea that people learn differently and that people have preferences in the way they go about learning. And, you know, that's the case. But the sad fact is that your preferences in learning don't necessarily correspond with what works. You know, it's perfectly possible for you to think you prefer a particular approach to learning and for that to be completely ineffectual because of those kind of problems of metacognition that we referred to earlier. But there's some fairly, another psychological reason is something called the mere exposure effect. Whereas when something gets out enough, if you hear something enough times, you tend to believe it, irrespective of whether it has any, you know, weight behind it or not. And if you look on things like YouTube and things like that now, there are so many more videos about, did you know we learn in one of three different ways, visual, auditory, or kinesthetic? It's nonsense, but there's so much of it. You have to, again, see it from the point of view that's from someone that hasn't done any kind of exposition in psychology or you know, had any instruction on how to learn effectively. It seems plausible to them. Like, you know, all myths and all misconceptions usually have some kind of kernel of plausibility or truth about them, but then they get horribly distorted or they go horribly wrong in another respect. So that's another kind of psychological reason, but I think institutions have a big role in this as well, and in some ways I think are very culpable in perpetuating bad ideas about learning. You know, there is, I think, sometimes, and I'm sorry if I'm getting slightly animated about this, but it's something I feel quite strongly about. I think sometimes learning and teaching research, and particularly when it comes to supporting students' independent learning, is almost treated as almost like second-rate scholarship or not a priority, which sounds a really weird thing to say for a university or something that's supposed to be concerned with learning and teaching, you'd think first and foremost. But when you look at some of the stuff that passes, you know, cuts muster in the learning and teaching, or what they profess to be the learning and teaching realms of the uni, and you say, would that be acceptable in another subject domain? Like, would we accept the equivalent of learning styles in biology or chemistry? So if someone went into neuropsychology, for example, and started talking about phrenology as if it was still a thing, you know, we hadn't dismissed it, would they be laughed out of the lecture theatre, wouldn't they? And yet we've got TEF gold rating institutions that are talking about learning styles, which is a critical, you know, with respect to something which is critical for students' learning. You know, we're offering them support and then we're giving them support, which is nonsense. You know, and I think sometimes if it's not a lack of scholarship, there's a lack of integration. So, you know, universities might have centres for excellence in teaching or learning and things like that. But how much of that knowledge and how much of that really good scholarship is then distilled down to the subject areas and actually used? And I would argue that doesn't happen as readily as it should. And how much, very importantly, does that also filter through to student support services, which sometimes can be actually rather divorced from, you know, centres for excellence in learning and teaching? You know, the two don't mesh up as well as you'd think they would. Most degree programmes, most of what the students do is in their own time. You know, a lot of it is independent studying. They don't spend all of their studying time in lectures, you know, or seminars. It's, you know, you've got to go home, you've got to hit the books. So given that's the way it works, we need to make sure that any of the good stuff that we're doing in the lectures and the seminars and the support we're giving them when they're on campus is matched by the provisions off campus. So what happens outside of the classroom? And I think sometimes perhaps institutions don't pay enough attention to what happens outside of the classroom, you know, and then they wonder why it goes wrong with things like student attainment and student progression. Well, if you're not looking at how students spend most of their time and making sure that they're being effective in their use of that time. So, sorry, that probably turned into a bit of a rant there, didn't it? But
it's okay. We all feel very passionate about it as well. So, so kind of on that same vein, obviously, we've kind of established it's difficult. You're kind of working against the system and, you know, very ingrained concepts. But for educators that and students, I suppose, that kind of are more aware of like metacognition and being aware of the best ways to study and things like that, how can they engage students in that, whether it be in school or at university level? Because like we said earlier, a lot of students, they think that they're doing fine because they've got grades up until this point. So like, how do you kind of like flip that switch in them and kind of make them start to be aware of these concepts?
Yeah, it's a very good question, because sometimes just telling people that what they're doing isn't going to work is, you know, is insufficient. That's not going to have the desired effect. But there are some really innovative processes that you can use to and have been used in the past to demonstrate the effectiveness of particular approaches like retrieval practice, for example. So one thing that happened in a psychology class, I read a study fairly recently, and they actually did a study on retrieval practice and, you know, split the students into groups. Some of them did the rereading, some of them did the retrieval practice, and then got the students to analyze the data and write the data up as, you know, as you would. And then they monitored their study habits over the next year. And surely that they found that the people that had done this particular lab relative to the students that hadn't had the benefit of that lab started to use retrieval practice much more, frequently then. And the thing about retrieval, once you get people going on it, then it serves as that metacognitive correction. You can't hide behind the fact you think you're doing it right anymore, because the results are telling you otherwise. But it's often just getting people started down on that road that can be the difficult thing. Another thing is to look at the relationship between things like elaborative interrogation and good practice when it comes to reading, note taking, and writing. So it's trying to, I think, pitch things sometimes as just good practice and demonstrate their effectiveness so that people engage with it organically. I think a good example of that is if you talk about sort of fairly what might be abstract concepts to people, like retrieval practice and elaborative interrogation, their immediate thing is, oh God, that sounds like our work. You know, I don't do that. But then if you look at the research that examines high attaining students compared to the students that don't attain so well, and you look at the amount of time they spend studying, the two groups don't differ very significantly. What they differ in terms of how they spend that time they've invested in studying. And sure enough, it's the students that do better that tend to be, you know, interrogating the information, thinking about how they'd articulate in their own words, practicing retrieval. And if you just think about a study strategy that lets people incorporate that organically, so it seems fairly easy and smooth, but actually they're doing very effortful cognition. Like, for example, the 3R approach. Have you heard 3R approach before? This sort of, so you sort of read, recite and then review. And the idea is you break your reading down into very small chunks, so you can then you put your reading aside, you try and recite that information. I always say try and write it down, because then it can become part of your notes, the note-taking process. But you can just try and verbalize it as well. That's how it was done originally. And then you go back to your notes and you compare your recollection with the notes. So effectively what you're doing there is organically incorporating this idea of retrieval practice, you know, explaining things in your own words, using your own words, into a very compact method of studying. And if people get in the habit of doing that and trying to do it in quite small chunks of sources rather than trying to memorize an entire chapter, if you've got, for example, a paragraph or a particular study, you know, put your book to one side, just shout out or write down what you can remember, then check it against the source for factual accuracy only. Don't check it for, you know, if you're as eloquent as the original author or anything like that. Just see if you got your facts straight, see what's missing, and then have another go. It's just iterative. The process should be iterative, and you should be aiming to get a little bit better, you know, a little bit more expansive in your recall every time. And the great thing is, if you're writing things down, you can modify your notes as you go. What you end up with then is notes that's composed in your own words that you've revised along the way and that are actually meaningful to you, rather than just trying to take down a chunk of someone else's work. You know, there's a lot of talk recently about, you know, for example, note taking between using written notes and computers, for example. And I think a lot of that is a bit of a red herring, really, because I think it's not so much what you're using as how you're using it. And the danger, if there is one, is that it's very easy to control C and control V when you're using a computer. When you're handwriting, obviously, you can't do that.
Yeah.
So those kind of things, I think it really is, it's demonstrating these things in action and giving students a way to incorporate them into their studying in a fairly organic way where they can see the effect almost immediately. And then it becomes almost like self-reinforcing after that.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant, brilliant. Just some really fantastic suggestions there. That brings us quite nicely to the last question, really, which is obviously given one sort of key recommendation is about how to almost sort of naturally embed some of those strategies into an approach to studying and learning. But are there maybe two or three other recommendations that you might give to a student who wants to improve their studying or their learning techniques?
Yeah, I mean, there are kind of variations on those techniques as well, because sometimes we mentioned earlier that sometimes students get very disheartened if they try retrieval practice and their first attempt is a bit of a disaster, you know, they get it all wrong. There's recent research about sort of diminishing cues retrieval practice, where you start off with fairly explicit cues and then as you become, you gradually remove them. So, you know, it might be like half of the word that you use and then only a quarter of the word, then just the first letter. So that can be useful for students that maybe find that process of retrieval practice a bit intimidating to start off with and get a bit disheartened.
Like scaffolding, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's really scaffolding. It's exactly what it is. Another thing as well, I think, is look at the way that you approach studying. I know this is an old chestnut, but if you're one of those people that do the kind of almost like binge studying where you just try and cram it into one really long marathon session, you know, stop doing that to yourself. You know, again, this research on that goes back to the late 1800s, Ebbinghaus and that. You know, we know that distributing your studying over a period of time, you know, into smaller, more frequent sessions works better. So start thinking about that. And if you're one of those people that find that you procrastinate viciously when you're trying to study, I'm guessing if you look at your study habits, that's why, is you're giving yourself these fairly long, extensive sessions. And of course, you're not enjoying them, particularly if you're not using effective study strategies. Because one of the things we know about procrastination is, in terms of the things that predict whether someone will procrastinate, it's stuff like frustration, boredom, and resentment, which are the three words you'd use if you're trying to cram things. I'm bored, I'm frustrated, and I really resent having to do this. You know, and people wonder why they don't get around to revision. So that's another thing. You've got to break things down. You have to reward yourself as well, because all of the things that are tempting you away from studying are very short-term rewards. And we love short-term rewards. It's hyperbolic discounting. We'll take a short-term reward that we can obtain, you know, even just a small reward, over a bigger but much more long-term reward, which is unfortunate when you're studying, because most of the things you do in studying are for some long-term reward, therefore a grade that exists potentially at some point in the future. Whereas that Game of Thrones box set that you've been meaning to watch will give you that reward right now, you know? So you've got to try and break things down into smaller chunks, reward yourself for having done them. So those are just, you know, a few other suggestions as well that are kind of well-proven in the literature. So I'll stick with the ones I've mentioned thus far, I think.
I was going to say, we're going to have to get you on another time and go through so much more stuff. I literally sit here and chat about it with you for ages. So unfortunately, I'm going to bring it to a close and we're going to move on to the recommendations part of the show. So our first recommendation is, of course, your book. So that's Dr. Paul Penn's book called The Psychology of Effective Studying, to Succeed in Your Degree. Yeah, she's waving around her coffee in the background. Big fan. And this is a fantastic book that presents really accessible advice on optimal study skills, but also on working collaboratively, beating procrastination, and developing skills in academic writing and delivering effective presentations. So I would say a must read for all students, really.
Thank you.
Paul also has an excellent YouTube channel covering all manner of topics on the psychology of effective studying. That's really helpful. And it's broken down into quite short videos, which is good bite-sized chunks, I found. And we'd like to give special mention to a series of videos over on that YouTube channel, which cover effective academic writing skills. We really recommend checking those out if you're a student involved in writing up research or involved in an intercalated degree involving dissertations or essay submissions. And I guess before we finish, Paul, we just wanted to check if you have any recommendations for our listeners at all.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things you should certainly check out. I mean, because it's become a kind of frequently mentioned concept in this podcast, Desirable Difficulties, Robert Bjork's site. And you'll have to forgive me, I can't remember what the lab's called now. I think, oh, goodness, that's embarrassing. I've forgotten what the lab's called. But if you just Google Robert Bjork's name, and you put something like Desirable Difficulties in it, it will come up very readily. And Robert has an amazing kind of list of articles and publications where you can read all about this concept of desirable difficulties and how you can leverage them into your studying and things like that. The learning scientists have a really nice selection of materials as well, which looks at sort of, you know, just posters summarizing things like retrieval practice and you know, elaborative interrogation and all the things that I've mentioned, but just in a single poster or a PowerPoint slide, which is really useful. Off the top of my head, I'm just thinking, forgive me, I can't remember his first name now, but it's the quite well-known Dunlosky paper. Is it Daniel Dunlosky? I've completely forgotten. I'm just very embarrassed now. But
no, don't worry. Dunlosky, Rawson,
and Moll.
I think I might have it somewhere on the floor in my office, actually. Yeah, but I refer to that paper quite a bit.
Yeah, it's Psychology in the Public Interest. And it's a systematic literature review looking at the utility of common study strategies. And it's a really, they deserve so much credit for doing that, because it's a very big, very accessible paper.
But it's a seminal paper, really, isn't it?
I think it promoted a lot of interest in the topic. And it's looking at these things like, okay, so these common strategies like, you know, highlighting, summarization, all that, where's the evidence for it? And it's really brought together a lot of evidence under a single paper. And it's a really nice launching paper for you to have a look at, I think. And I believe they have a website as well, which looks at, you know, studying and the application of sort of psychological knowledge to studying. So that's certainly worth checking out.
Amazing. Thank you so much for those recommendations. I'm sure our listeners will get a lot out of those. And we'll, of course, provide the links for all recommendations in the show notes. So that brings us nicely to the end of the episode. A huge thanks to our guest, Dr. Paul Penn,
for joining us
today.
You're very welcome. I hope it was useful.
So good. And thank you for sharing some really helpful insights and tips with us. And of course, thank you to you, our listeners. So goodbye for now.
Goodbye.
And if you enjoyed the podcast, please do leave us a review on iTunes and give us a follow on Instagram @thehippocampuspodcast or on Twitter @hippocampus_pod.